Never compromise on your unit economics. Hello, this is Jonathan Mays, editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business. And in this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, I speak with Justin Rosenberg, the founder of the fast casual chain Honeygrow. Justin founded Honeygrow in 2012, and it was going quite well until 2018. He then talks about why the company stopped growing that year and what Honeygrow did to get back on the growth track. Hint, Honeygrow stopped making compromises on its unit economics. We also talk about where the chain is growing and why smaller towns are apparently a recipe for success. Indeed, sometimes they're too successful. Justin talks about all of that. This is an interesting conversation on A Deeper Dive this week, so please check it out. All right, I'm here with Justin Rosenberg. Justin, welcome to the podcast.
Jonathan, thank you for having me.
All right, so what's going on at Honeygrow, sir? Tell us a little bit about the chain.
How are things going? We're doing well, thank God. We're 40 restaurants here, predominantly in the Northeast. We're based in Philadelphia, but we're in Boston, Pittsburgh, DC Metro, and kind of that triangle. Thank God things are okay. Just working.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about how the company got started.
Yeah. So my background, to make it quick, I was a Penn State undergrad history major, Spanish minor, not really sure what to do with my life. My first job out of college was actually at a chocolate factory in South Philadelphia, which is pretty cool. Ironically, I gained weight and wound up eventually getting into real estate. And I really wanted to create my own business. My passions have always been food and building something. And I just was like, all right, I'm going to pursue this. And at the time, I had some serious health issues. I wouldn't say it's because of the chocolate factory, but it didn't help. Fun fact, become friends with the sample lady and she'll hook you up. I wound up weighing an unhealthy amount of weight on myself and went to the doctor. And the doctor's like, look, you know, I was 26. He's like, if you want to see your daughter walk down the aisle when she's older, you need to get your health in order now. I had high cholesterol, high blood sugar. It really scared me. So I wound up going plant-based for 2 years and I was making a bunch of salads for lunch and the stuff I left over, I would put into a wok at night with some noodles. And literally thought about how there's a million bowl concepts and salad concepts and burger concepts and whatever. And I just wanted to create something really distinct and unique, which led to Honeygrow.
Mm-hmm. How'd that feel? I have to ask this question. How did it feel like you're 26 years old and then a doctor tells you something like that? I must have hit you hard.
You know, yeah. I mean, it was like a weird, when you're in your 20s, you just feel like you're invincible, right? I'm mm-hmm. like, wait, this, I'm okay. And he's like, you're not. I had like a fatty liver. It was very scary. It knocked me out. You know, it was a scary moment. And like, I really need to get my life in order. I was younger. I definitely was in shape, let go. And I needed to get back in order.
Mm-hmm. How much weight you lost by changing your diet?
Yeah. Well, I weighed a 240 at the time. And I'm an unhealthy 240. It wasn't like a muscular 240. Mm-hmm. And I weigh 183 pounds today. So, you know. Nice. What is that math? 40 plus 17. So 57 pounds altogether.
Right. And so did you do a lot of cooking beforehand? Like, I mean, were you like someone who cooked a lot previously and that just kind of forced the issue?
I've always been passionate about food. As a kid growing up in New York, I was able to go to some awesome restaurants, not just like really great fine dining restaurants, but like best Greek places in Astoria, Queens, and the best bagel places in Brooklyn, and really got exposed to some beautiful places. My grandfather actually used to work with a restaurant critic. I think she worked for the Daily News back in the 90s, and they would just tag me along as a 10-year-old kid, and I would just like eat the best stuff. Or like, hey, who has the best? Now it's like everyone thinks they know the best pizza spots, but back in the day, it was like, we're going to this place called DeFara's, which is this hole in the wall in Brooklyn. And you just sit there and it's like magic with the guy just making the pizzas quiet. You're like, this is the greatest stuff ever. So I was exposed to that as a kid, really figured that's my passion. And I wound up working in a restaurant in DC for a little bit to learn the business, learn how to get beat up in the kitchen, learn how to make really beautiful food prep. But no, I don't have a culinary background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you decided, so you were making all this food. You thought, hey, this is something we could be a restaurant company. So you, and then you got a job in the restaurant business.
Yeah, exactly. So I was working as a financial analyst for a company that owned shopping malls. And mm-hmm. I would see the sales information for various tenants. Chick-fil-A doing crazy numbers 6 days a week and like middle of nowhere. And I'm like, why? Like, what is it exactly that's doing this? And even the Apple store doing crazy numbers per square foot and really beating anchor tenants in total sales. I'm like, what makes a really great brand? What makes it distinct, unique? But I noticed like Chipotle opening up back in like the, you know, late 2000s, some of these properties just killing it. And I just thought about like, if you could create a really great brand and create something where customers want to come back, like it's not rocket science, the restaurant business, it's really hard, but it's not rocket science. So you can figure out something that's differentiated and something you could be the best of, let's get after it. So that's pretty much, you know, what I set out to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, how did you, at what point did you decide, all right, it's time to make the leap? Did you just start making a bunch of food, or how did that work? How did that process go?
Yeah. So I was working in this world and I wound up thinking, I want to create this business. I went to business school at Temple University in Philly, and I'm like, I know how to write a business plan. I don't know crap about the restaurant business. So I wound up taking a mega bus on Friday nights down to DC. I should have just found something in Philly, but knew a guy, hooked me up, let me work, and would work, you know, Friday night rush, Saturday morning prep, Saturday night rush, come back on Sundays, did for a little bit. And, you know, I love the business. I just love cooking. I love seeing customers happy. I love the team camaraderie when you bang out a tough shift. I realized like this, I love this. It's more fun for me than sitting in front of a computer crunching numbers. And that's kind of what I want to do. I want to just spend my life building a great brand and getting out there. It's very exciting.
Did anybody ask you what the heck you were doing, taking a mega bus down to DC to work in a restaurant on the weekends?
No. Well, fun story. People would be like, who the hell is this guy getting in the way in the kitchen? Like, they're like, get out of the way. They'd be like, ah. You know, if you work in the kitchen, you know. And then I finally started getting some respect in the kitchen because I was able to do basic things and they relied on me, which is nice. The bigger issue was Monday mornings when I'd come in and, you know, I was tired, you know, whatever, working in the restaurant all weekend. And then Monday mornings coming back. At the time, my wife was like, what are you doing? And she's supportive. We had a 2-year-old daughter, and I would just be a dick on Mondays, excuse my language. I would just be angry. People would come in my office like, hey, you got a second? I'm like, no. I was just like tired. But eventually I had to curb that because I think people were like, something's wrong with this guy. I don't want to lose my job. So right. It was pretty tough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's tough to not be a jerk on Mondays in the best of times.
Yeah.
While you're spending your entire weekend working in a restaurant. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So how did the first, when did you open your first Honey Grill?
First one opened 2012, June 8th, here in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did the first few locations go?
First one was a bit of a mess in the beginning. It was kind of like, we just jammed this model in a 1,500 square foot space, hoping for the best, or I did. I had two investors at the time, two partners, and let me do my thing. Had a GM who was not the best GM, and I had to learn. I wasn't the best GM either at all. And then we signed a lease for a second location, which I remember thinking like, man, I don't know if this makes sense. My wife saw me write an email to my partner saying we should wait to sign this lease. And she's like, do not write that email. I'm like, okay, thank God it did not. We opened the second one about 8 months later, and that one just took off. I mean, I had confidence at that point. I knew what I was doing. I got beaten up enough. Knew how to build a team, take care of a team, get rid of low performers. So that one took off, and then we started gaining a lot of success and visibility. And the first one then just went gangbusters.
Really? Really. So, your wife basically kept you going.
She is an unsung hero of this organization for sure. And to this day, you know, with me coming home, freaking out, you know, she's definitely an unsung rock of Honey Grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cause it sounds so, but you also made all your mistakes with the first one, and then the second one, smooth sailing.
Yeah, I mean, I would nothing smooth sailing. There's always some chop, but it definitely was a lot better, a lot of confidence. I had a better team at that point. And the team was myself and one other person who became our director of ops, Laura. And we were literally bouncing around both restaurants. And it was really fun. Like, it was just, we're cooking, we're making the sauces. The cool thing about Honey Grill, everything's freshly made to order. So you got to know how to cook. And I was like, all right, I'm going to cook all day and work with customers. And they started working, which was really fun and exciting. It just was really cool. And at the time, like a lot of other fast casual bowl concepts started coming about. And I'm just like, look, everyone's doing it's like the movie Multiplicity with Michael Keaton, where it's like a replication of a replication of replication. And it was almost sad. I'm just like, oh, look, let's just stay focused on what we do. And, you know, I'm very proud of that.
Yeah. 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 Well, I mean, the restaurant industry has been built on repetition. And copycat concepts. Sure. I mean, I'm trying to imagine how many restaurant chains wouldn't exist if they couldn't copy what somebody else did.
89% of the chicken concepts that I keep reading about every day. There's so many burger concepts, mm-hmm. and some are awesome, don't get me wrong, but it's a lot of the same stuff. And look, we definitely got influence from other concepts, like Mongolian barbecues, for example, you know, flat top grill, you know, those kind of things where you're going in picking your stuff. Unquestionably was an influence for me. I would go to Mongolian barbecue at Penn State, and I'm like, oh, this is cool. Someone should do this one day. So certainly influences for sure. But I didn't want to do something that was just a copycat. That's just not fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So how did the pandemic go for you guys?
Pandemic was hard in the beginning. Our sales dropped 75% out of the gate. We wound up staying open in the Northeast, which was tough. We fortunately got a PPP check, which kept us alive. We reduced some folks here at the support center, reduced headcount, and it was a very hard time, like the rest of us have experienced. You know, we really leaned into DoorDash and Uber Eats and Grubhub, which honestly, it was 8% prior to the pandemic and blew up to 45%. Today, it's sticky around 36%, 37%. And that kept us alive, that and curbside pickup, which is about 55% of the business. We adopted that, I think, like the week after we had our tech guy figure it out on the app and just got it going. So we stayed alive, you know, that was the most important thing and kept the doors open. And then luckily by July, August, we were actually doing okay. You know, we made enough changes in the organization to be a bit positive and really to be almost, not definitely not cash flow positive, but kept it afloat and then started comping 2021 and opened up our first restaurant again in 2020. So we made it through. That one did well.
Mm-hmm. No. I don't think people quite appreciate just how much of the restaurant industry was saved by that PPP program.
I agree. I think the PPP sometimes gets a bad rap, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it literally went to paying employees. It was like we wound up being able to keep afloat and stay alive. And we wouldn't have, I mean, we would have had to raise some capital, which would have been painful. You know, it was a tough time, but we wound up luckily getting that. And no, it was good. Thank God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how's the business different today than it was 5 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, we're just a different company today. We learned a lot from the mistakes through the years. There certainly were quite a few. You know, we have 40 restaurants today, and I stopped growth back in 2018, flipped the switch back on in 2020 after spending a lot of time mastering the model, looking at it objectively. What's not working here? Let's put your ego aside. Where should we be looking at? Where should we not be going real estate-wise? And then since then, really, since 2020, we've opened 17 locations, all successful. You know, we've crossed the threshold of the $100 million run rate barrier, which I'm very excited about. We're opening up 13 to 15 locations this year. A lot of lessons learned. I mean, that's like a book I'll write one day. But, you know, it's definitely been a wild ride and not looking to make the same mistakes twice.
Yeah. What kind of mistakes did you have to fix? Because you're going pretty well. I assume you were going pretty well up until that particular time. What happened in 2018?
Yeah, so we were doing great up until through 2016. And we had some issues started developing. One was the construction costs started going up really tremendously. So the model wasn't penciling out the way it really should have been. So just to give some perspective, our model today is less than a 2-year payback with about, call it a close to 70% cash on cash return. You know, we could build these things for net of TI of about $1 million. And if we can't do that, we don't do the deal. I mean, it really is as simple as that. You know, we really need to make sure that we can build this thing for the right cost, generate the right sales, and the restaurants are producing 23 to 24% store level EBITDA. That's how we're underwriting it, and that's what we do. And it has a lot to do with where you're going, when you're going, who's next to you, day parts, a lot of science and art to it. But that's really great real estate. For example, there's stuff we're looking at in areas of Pennsylvania that a lot of folks wouldn't even know. And we're seeing a lot of national chains that are also in the fast casual space. Maybe they serve salad. Maybe they serve other things you put in a bowl. But they're willing to pay crazy rents because real estate's tight still and willing to take less of a TI check, which as great as real estate is, we walk. I think the discipline has been really key for us that we're willing to walk away if it doesn't make sense for us, which is key. And kudos to our development team for doing an unbelievable job on that. It's not me. I mean, they're really out there making this happen. So I think that's one of them too. I had a second concept called Mini Grow, which instead of really getting the construction cost where it needs to be and is today, we thought that was kind of it. So we figured let's pull out of urban for Honey Grow. Let's do suburban and put urban, this miniature version of Honey Grow, which is more of like a smaller assembly line noodle brand. You know, I opened like three in Manhattan instead of doing one in Philadelphia. So I made every mistake imaginable, really out of hubris, thinking, hey, you've opened 15 Honey Grows, this will work. And suddenly one day it doesn't work. And it's a very eye-opening, humbling experience for a leader and a CEO and an entrepreneur. We got through it. You know, our investors were very supportive and helped us. And our team, those that stayed, were great. A lot of folks jumped ship, like, this place is going downhill. We're out of here. Opened 7 markets in 1 year, including Chicago and Boston. And none of them were working. So we were just draining cash and had a high G&A. You know, we thought we needed this big team to really get us there. And so by, you know, 2018, I'm like, you don't need the big team. We shouldn't have grown this quickly. That's hubris and stupid. We were really trying to get after in front of copycat brands. We saw a lot of brands doing stir fry salads, like, oh, we got to get there first, which was dumb. And ultimately, this second concept, we're like, look, let's really, we have something with Honey Grow, let's make it better. And so in 2019, that's what we did. It's just nothing sexy or cool. It was kind of boring. We're like, hey, let's make sure we can build the sales, profitability, cash on cash return, and make it strong and keep the G&A in check. And then, and know who the model is or what the model is. Don't go to downtown, you know, Chicago. Let's go to Arundel Mills, Maryland. Let's go to Christiana, Delaware. You know, we're in Boston. Our two locations in Boston are our best sales, right? We could do well doing more in Boston, but we're opening in Peabody, Massachusetts pretty soon, and it works. And that really is part of the lessons that we learned through the years.
Yeah. So that era between 2012 and 2016 was, and I think it continued after that. But my recall is that it was just an era of overeager development on the part of fast casual concepts. And then the thing that I kept hearing over and over and over again at the time was that lease, you know, the cost of developing in many of these markets, particularly in the Northeast markets where you guys were developing, were getting out of hand. And then my concern, obviously, at the time was that brands were being too aggressive in terms of what kind of leases that they were willing to sign, because eventually that, you know, causes problems down the line. But there was so much pressure on some of these brands to grow, to show growth, that they were willing to compromise on their unit economics, which you should never do.
That's really well said. Never compromise on your unit economics. To get your unit economics, you need to know your market. You need to know who your market is. You know, you need to know where you should be going. You should be doing the research. You should be doing the work. And as cool and sexy as, you know, to be in cool downtown location somewhere where your brand is the pinnacle of cool, I think making money is cool. And opening up in areas that people don't know per se yet perform really well. I mean, I look at brands like Chick-fil-A, you know, a lot of brands that are out there that in towns you've never heard of, but they're doing, you know, $10 million AUVs, right? Like, that's really exciting for me. Like, we don't do $10 million AUVs, right? But like, those towns, they are. And we hear that, we're like, oh, cool, let's go there. And then suddenly we do very well. And again, it's just, we're offering something very different than you know, what's out there, which is cool. You know, we have that kind of intersection of it's tasty and good, and it's good for you as long as you, you know, or whatever you think is good for you. And I know that sounds like some asterisk, but, you know, if you order a Cobb salad, is it going to be good for you? It's high in calories? Probably not. You order the freshly made whole wheat noodles with some stuff in it, and as 7 grams of protein and 17 grams of fiber, yeah, it's going to be good for you. So it's healthy as you want to make it, but certainly that intersection of tasty and healthy is what we do. And, you know, targeting markets where that's not really happening.
Well, people in suburbs in smaller cities, you know, want, you know, they want to eat healthier too. I mean, and frankly, yeah, and frankly, they appreciate it. They appreciate when a hot concept opens it.
We've seen that too. We become like, it's almost like a gift and a curse. Like, we'll open up, like, we opened Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, and actually that's where Taylor Swift is from. Open up Wyomissing, PA, which is like a little bit in between Harrisburg and Philadelphia, rural area. And we were doing close to $30,000 days out of the gate, and it stabilized tremendously since then. But it's good because, you know, it's like, wow, people are discovering us. It's bad because, you know, your operation is not going to be great out of the gate and your team's going to get beat up and the food won't be as good or coming as quick. And that's what matters at the end of the day. Like, the food has to be good and the experience has to be good and like, and great. Like, hospitality's got to be good. The team's exhausted and the GM throws his keys on the table. I guarantee you it will not be a good experience. So, you know, those are, it's like a, it's a blessing and a curse, more a curse. And we subsequently have been opening up way quieter in areas where we know that can happen, which has been much better for us.
How did you ensure that you could open quieter in places like that?
We don't spend the money on digital marketing prior to an opening. We're not putting the balloons and everything outside. We're not inviting everyone for friends and family and community days. We're really not creating any hype. We're literally opening doors. And if it takes a little bit longer to get to a good number, that's fine. Markets where you don't know us, we'll probably open the doors, but we'll probably kick in a little bit quicker to make sure that we can get folks to discover us, which is key.
I'm just going to kind of, is that a little bit, I mean, do you have to resist a temptation to market a store and to get people in there? I mean, does that take a little bit of discipline not to do that? Or because that goes sort of against the grain a little bit, because theoretically, you know, I mean, you see a lot of brands that just like really want, they'll hold events. I mean, you mentioned Chick-fil-A, they'll have people lining up at, you know, outside, they'll actively encourage it. People lining up outside overnight. No chicken sandwiches with the night in the tent, in my opinion. But still, I mean, does that take a little discipline to resist that?
No, I it doesn't, because we've effed up so many times with openings where we can't handle that initial volume, and the damage it does to your brand in that market is not worth it. And when you're waiting way too long for your food and it's incorrect, hospitality sucks, it's a dirty restaurant, and you know, it doesn't taste good. It's horrible. I mean, we exist for the opposite of that. You know, my passion is seeing like people enjoying the food and having a good time. And that's why I'm in this business. I'm totally okay opening doors and waiting. And of course, like there is risk, right? So we opened Alexandria, Virginia, which is our further south location. We put a little money behind it. It was a little slow in the beginning. And we said, all right, well, let's put some gas here on the pedal. Gas on the pedal, put on the gas, I don't know. But we pushed a little bit and then suddenly folks are coming in. And it's like, okay, cool. And it was a way better opening for us. And the team's happy. The GM wasn't upset. The team wasn't crunched. You want the team to work there too, right? Like there's a lot that goes into it. So sure, for my ego gratification, would it be awesome to do $30,000 days out of the gate? Right. But you're not going to keep up 30,000. You're going to go to $5,000 days. So I'd rather go from, you know, 10 to 8 and stabilize, right? And then beat 10 18 months later. It's just way better.
I remember one time years ago, when Sonic opened in my market in Minneapolis, and the operator and people at the time, Sonic was, you know, when they would open in a new market, because they had national advertising at the time. Well, they still do, but I mean, they had national advertising. And so everybody knew who Sonic was, but there was no Sonic in this area. And so when they opened, I mean, the lines were crazy here. And the franchisees at the time were really nervous about it. Very nervous about it. They were like, they actually didn't like it. And they were worried about, you know, that it would flame out. And in this market, that's exactly what happened. And they never really grew with it over the long term. So that's a really good point. Like if you grow too aggressive, it is difficult to serve people, and people want to keep, especially if it's a new concept that they're not really familiar with. They want to, you know, you want them to be able to come back. So that makes a ton of sense to me.
Yeah. You want to pressure test the team. They're a new team. There's some veterans in there as well. It's a long game for me, right? Like I don't need the first month of crazy sales. I'd rather 18 months in, 12 months in, performing above a certain threshold on top line, but also producing that key metric of the 20% plus on store level profit and getting that less than 2 year payback. Like that to me is what matters. So that means in the first 3 weeks, be a little bit slower. Doesn't matter. That's fine. You know, the team will get used to it, and then they'll move up. It's okay. Yeah.
So, where do you go from here? What's the next few years look like?
Yeah. Well, it's a lot. We're growing, right? So we're doing it very different than we did in the past. We're in seven markets. We're growing in the existing markets. We are looking at deals now, beginning to look in the Midwest, which is exciting, and really putting our foot out there a little bit further south. I mean, continues growth in Virginia, but really not a like, hey, we're going to plant a flag in Denver kind of strategy, which is what I did wrong years ago. And some can do it and some can't, but really for us, we love concentric circles. In terms of growth, you know, the DM can have an easier life. There's always a little bit of brand awareness helpful there, right? So continued growth in those markets, just pushing forward. And honestly, the key is really a continuous focus on finding good people, which it sounds cliche, but I literally give out like business cards at gas stations when I talk to like a really good employee. Like, if you want to work with us, that's cool. I really want to make sure that we have great employees. Especially great general managers, especially great district managers. The GM is the most important person in this company. We have a elite GM program at Honeygrow, which is a lot like the restaurateur program at Chipotle, how it used to be, where folks can, if you create the right culture and the right team, and magic happens. And we have three elite GMs, one about to join the ranks. They make more money. The team is happier. They can take vacations. The food tastes better. The costs are in line. It's actually amazing when you have a great leader. So a continued focus on making sure we can find great folks around the restaurants.
A general manager is the most important position in the restaurant space.
No
It's
question.
literally the magic bullet. You want to fix everything, you just have a good manager, general manager running your store.
Oh my
It's a
God.
different.
I mean, you see this too in your world. Like, there's so many CEOs that don't even bring that up. And like, they don't realize how important at the end of the day, like, it's about the customer experience and managing the business, right? But a general manager who's amazing will generate amazing business results by creating like great experiences for the team and for the customer over and over again. It's not rocket science. It really isn't. It's not easy, but it's not rocket science.
I mean, it's they're running a small business, a little small operation, and I mean, full well, like most people don't quit a job, they quit a boss.
What a
And if
boss.
that boss sucks, if that boss is an asshole, they're leaving. I mean, it's just, and if the boss is good, they're staying. It's really just not hard. Or not
It's so
challenging.
well said. Prior to starting Honeygrow, I had some good bosses and had some bad bosses, but I would leave when I was frustrated with the person I worked for. Definitely.
All right, last and probably the single most important question I ask you is in the entire podcast. Does your wife ever say, "I told you so" now, anytime you have a really good opening? Because if she doesn't, she probably should.
Yeah, she does. She does. But
That's good.
yeah, well earned. And my wife is probably the most humble human being of all time. She's been a supporter through thick and thin and remains that way. And I don't talk to a lot of people about this. You're asking the question, so I'll say, but she's riding this way with me in many ways. So we have three kids, 15, 11, my girls, my son is 8. We all kind of live it. My wife actually is the number one app user in the company, like in the whole like
Really?
loyalty program. So we eat a lot of Honeygrow, but she's always been very supportive.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you guys are eating your own cooking. Justin, this was great. Really appreciate you joining me on the podcast.
Anytime, Jonathan. My pleasure.
And that should do it for this week's episode of A Deeper Dive, which was edited, as always, by Spoons, artwork by Nico Hines. You may find this and other episodes of the podcast on our website at www.restaurantbusinessonline.com/article/deeper-dive. And you may subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I'm Jonathan Mays, your host, podcast producer, and the editor-in-chief of Restaurant Business. Thank you for listening.